Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Along with Jim Garrity of National Review, I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And Jim, when we say write this date down, we never do, but we probably should today. But the words Good Martini, New York Times, and Nicholas Kristof usually don't wind up in the same sentence. But today they do. Because unless he's writing about the Sudan, I'm pretty much in disagreement with just about every analysis he has. But today he's talking about what he's learned from actually going to see the impact of a federal program in a place called Jackson, Kentucky. And what he learned is that people who, at least in this part of the country, who get money from the federal government through something called the Supplemental Security Income Program intentionally keep their kids illiterate so the government checks keep rolling in. The more he looks into this, the more he's appalled by what's happening. And here are two paragraphs that you almost never hear from a liberal, and that's why it's a good martini. It's not that people are still illiterate. It's that liberals are seeing that sometimes big government doesn't work. This is painful for a liberal to admit, Kristof writes, but conservatives have a point when they suggest that America's safety net can sometimes entangle people in a soul-crushing dependency. Our poverty programs do rescue many people, but other times they backfire. Just one paragraph further down, it says, anti-poverty programs also discourage marriage. In means-tested programs like SSI, a woman raising a child may receive a bigger check if she refrains from marrying the hard-working guy she likes, yet marriage is one of the best forces to blunt poverty. In married couple households, only one child in 10 grows up in poverty, while almost half do in single-mother households. So the light bulb might not be 100 watts, but at least it's on at the New York Times, and that's pretty impressive.
Two thoughts kind of come out of this. The first is that Nicholas Kristof, love him or hate him, and there are plenty of days we don't like him. Look, one of the driving forces in his journalism is that he wants to know about what makes people poor. And he goes to some of the worst places in the world, Sudan, etc., and talks to people and really takes out a sense of what's going wrong. Now, sometimes this means he supports foreign aid programs and put money into the pockets of the wrong people and make deals with corrupt governments and stuff like that. There are times we're going to disagree with him. But this comes from him going to West Virginia and talking to these people and figuring out what kind of decisions are they making. And it's kind of, you know, a good illustrator of how the best of intentions can end up with disastrous results. You would think that, you know, somebody who's, you see somebody, a family that's struggling, well, here's an extra $698 per month to take care of you. However, as a result of that, you have these parents who make this terrible, horrific decision, which is to take their kids out of reading classes because they want their children to be considered to have an intellectual disability. I'd like to think that this, you know, appearing in the New York Times under a non-crazy right-winger columnist like Nicholas Kristof, this would get liberals or folks in Washington to seriously re-examine this system. This is like step one, which is to get our friends on the left to realize, okay, even if we don't agree with all of the conservative rhetoric on entitlement programs, there are some problems here and they need to get addressed. And if we can get those addressed, that's a genuine good martini. This is only a tepidly good martini today of them recognizing the problem. But secondly, I kind of look at this and I wonder, like, we've had a lot of, you know, griping after the election, what's wrong with conservatives, what's wrong with Republicans. You know, it says something that Kristof is the guy who does this study, finds this thing, and is able to spotlight it. I kind of wish we had been able to do this. Although I kind of wonder if conservative media had spotlighted this, whether it would have been seen as garden variety demonizing the poor and blaming the poor for their own problems. When in fact, Nicholas Kristof is here saying, look, we have set up an incentive system in which these people have, you know, get better rewards for staying in poverty and staying in terrible circumstances than for taking the steps that will get them to climb out of this mess. And it's serious food for thought, and hopefully this column leads to some sort of action, some sort of reform to these systems. Because as you can see, we're getting the exact opposite results of what we want. The old saying is, you know, if you don't like something, tax it. If you want to see more of something, subsidize it. And in this case, we are quite literally subsidizing illiterate children and single parenthood.
Yay. Good job, America. Good job, America. You're going to be hearing that a lot from us over the next 4 years, I have a feeling. Our bad martini is kind of along the same lines, government dependency and the increasing nature of that. According to data from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, food stamps reached another high in September. This is reporting from the Daily Caller. The most recent numbers released on Friday show that 47,710,324 people were enrolled in the program in September. Over 47 million. That's up over 600,000 from the numbers in August. Just to show you how things have changed in a generation or two. Right now, 1 in 6.5 people in America are on food stamps. In the 1970s, it was 1 out of every 50. This is the new normal, and this is what was ratified just about a month ago, Jim.
I was just slack-jawed at 600,000 increasing in just a couple of months. I mean, that's unbelievable, because you'd like to think that whatever is the state of the economy, Greg, it doesn't seem, you know, enormously different than it did in August, right?
Right.
I mean, you know, the unemployment rate is roughly the same, wage growth, all of the traditional indicators of the economy are that, I mean, you and I talk about how lousy the economy is doing right now on this podcast regularly, but I don't think we've seen an enormous downturn in the past, 3 months or 4 months or so. And yet somehow there's been this huge spike in food stamp use. So there are a couple possibilities. One possibility is it is no longer stigmatized, that this is seen as something that it's okay to do, whatever income level you're at. Maybe we've made the income level that once you qualify for this is too generous. Two, as it's been often said, state programs measure their effectiveness by how many people are on food stamps. And as Paul Ryan likes to say, shouldn't we be measuring our effectiveness of our programs by how many people get off food stamps and how many people, you know, achieve a living wage and a level in which they don't no longer need it? The third possibility out there is fraud. Apparently, the amount of fraud and people collecting, you know, putting down false information to collect these benefits is up enormously. Or, you know, just kind of a certain sense of just a broad-based economic cultural despair. In which people say, hey, look, you might as well take it, you know, nothing's getting any better anytime soon, and this is what government is here for. And it's a in a way, we may be in a much worse sense than we were in the late 70s, of kind of the level of cultural despair in which Americans believe that they cannot achieve for themselves, they cannot rise out of their circumstances, and the only hope for any mild improvement in their lives comes from collecting benefits from the government.
Jim, we always wonder on the first Friday of the month, what happens to all these people who no longer look for work? I think we're starting to get at least a clearer picture of part of the answer. I don't think that's exactly where it's coming from, but you got to think a chunk of it's coming from there, and that's pretty discouraging, to say the least.
Well, a couple also, just to make one last point, kind of something I wrote a couple months ago. Somebody had said that the number of people who have been overdue on their mortgages was like now more than 700 some days, which is, you know, people able to do the math will say it's getting close to 2 years. And somebody said, if you haven't made a mortgage payment in 2 years, it's not that you've fallen behind on payments, you're going through hard times. It's that you're squatting. You just stop paying, and you're just sitting living in your house for as long as you can. And he said, we have a squatter economy. We have a black market economy. I can't help but wonder how many people are making money under the table, being paid in cash in often, you know, somewhat shady circumstances, then applying for the benefits like these. Because, you know, this would be those cases of fraud I was talking about earlier, in which they have income, but it's not being reported to the government. And because they don't report that, they have little or no income. Thus, they qualify for benefits like these. And this is what you see in Greece. This is what you see in third world countries, a culture of fraud taking root, in which nobody is very honest about these things. And everybody just tries to, you know, finagle as much as they can under the government. And it's a very, very bad set of circumstances for the United States to see this becoming a more widespread practice.
On to martini number three now, Jim. And obviously, it was a rough year for us at the ballot box. Although, as the primary season unfolded, I think most conservatives and most Republicans knew this wasn't the strongest field we had accumulated. But a lot of people are far more excited about the potential field for 2016, depending on who ultimately gets in the race. If there's a Rubio in there, a Jindal, potentially a Ryan, people are going to be a little more enthused about that than the field we saw last time, I think it's safe to say. Except for one man, one Newt Gingrich, former Speaker of the House, part of the weak field in 2012 for the Republicans, I might add. He was looking at the lessons of 2012 as part of the roundtable on Meet the Press, and then looking at the apparent consolidation of a lot of key Democratic figures around the possibility of a Hillary Clinton candidacy in 2016. And, well, here's Newt's real upbeat message for the Republican Party.
If their competitor in 16 is going to be Hillary Clinton, supported by Bill Clinton and presumably a still relatively popular President Barack Obama, trying to win that will be truly the Super Bowl. And the Republican Party in its today is incapable of competing at that level.
Well, thanks for that pep talk, Newt. And we'll see. Obviously, there are lessons to be learned. There are things that the party needs to improve on. Get out the vote, number one, and perhaps a more effective message that cuts across all different demographics. But the idea that Hillary Clinton can't be beat, I think, has been disproven in the past, Jim, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, pretty clearly. Now, here's the thing. There's two ways you can interpret this remark. The first is to say, look, Republicans, we need to look at ourselves honestly. We didn't get it done in 2012, and right now we couldn't beat anybody. I suppose that's one way the coach could kind of offer a pep talk to say, hey, let's wake up. We got to improve. Having said that, I don't think this is necessarily a helpful message. This kind of reminded me of the right-wing social engineering comment he made about Paul Ryan's reform plan. It's something about Newton Sunday shows that he inevitably ends up getting into trouble. The second kind of flip side is that so Newt, I'm not so sure you were a big part of the solution this past cycle. I think a lot of people said that he had one quick peak in the South Carolina primary. I've heard some folks make the argument that our primary debates throughout 2011 looked like a freak show to a lot of Americans. And we came across as a bunch of lunatics, and we came across as folks who didn't have serious solutions to the problems that they felt in their lives. What we talked about, the sense of lingering lack of economic opportunity and loss of social mobility, and a sense cultural and political and economic stagnation. I know how Newt loves to come up with his ideas and let's have the kids do janitorial work and all kinds of stuff like that. And I'm sure that having declared the Republican Party doomed against Hillary Clinton, I'm sure in a couple of days Newt will come out with some 5-point plan for American renewal, and he'll probably have a book out next year and all kind of stuff. But I'm really not convinced that Newt Gingrich is part of our long-term solution, and comments like this kind of make me say, I'm ready for Newt Gingrich to ride off into the sunset. I'm not really impressed with what he offered Republicans this cycle. And I think I don't really have much faith in his ability to be the architect of the comeback. I think it's time for a new generation of folks on the right to step forward. And I'm not really convinced that Hillary Clinton really is this unstoppable steamroller that he is painting her to be. I also kind of marvel. I mean, Hillary Clinton is going to be 69 in 2016, Greg. And no, everybody kind of just kind of shrugs that off. That is the age that Ronald Reagan was when he was elected in 1980. I just kind of observe that. Mrs. Clinton, I know Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was not a friend of mine, but I was a fan of his. You're no Ronald Reagan. And I kind of wonder, it's kind of this just broad assumption that Hillary wants to be president of the United States someday. And I'm not, she's had quite a few opportunities to kind of push for it if she wanted to challenge the president, et cetera. Looks exhausted from 4 years as being Secretary of State. I'm not quite so convinced Clinton's running, but if she is, I don't think it does Republicans much good to talk about her as if she's the, Stay Puft Marshmallow Man coming along to squash all of us, and we have nothing to throw up against her.
Great metaphor.
It exactly just popped into my head as Ray Stantz said.
Nice.
We have chosen the form of the destroyer.
Jim, have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us again on Tuesday for the next edition of the Three Martini Lunch.